There was a time when the Bassett Furniture Company in Bassett, Virginia, was the largest producer of wood furniture in the world. The company was founded in 1902 by John Bassett and remained in family hands for nearly a century. As the company grew, it provided good, steady jobs for thousands of artisans and laborers who lived in Henry County, Virginia. But in the 1980s, Bassett began faltering as foreign manufacturers flooded the United States with cheaper furniture made by low-wage workers in Taiwan, China, and Indonesia. Like so many other U.S. manufacturers, Bassett fought back by outsourcing its product, contracting to have its furniture built by low-wage foreign workers. One man refused to follow the trend, John Bassett III. He'd been exiled from his family business and had taken up as CEO of a furniture company some 100 miles south of Bassett. From there, Bassett III waged war on the foreign competition. He was determined to save jobs for his U.S. workers and to prove he could make a profit with domestic production. John Bassett III's story is at the center of Beth Macy's book, Factory Man. It not only tells the rollicking story of the Bassett family intrigues, it also documents the devastating toll that globalization has taken on so many U.S. manufacturing towns. Beth Macy is a journalist who's won numerous awards for her work writing for a number of national magazines. This is her first book. Beth Macy, welcome to Two-Way Street.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me who John Bassett III is and why we should know about him and you wanted to write a book about him.
He is a larger-than-life character. He's a third-generation furniture maker, originally hailed from Bassett, Virginia, a name you'll recognize because that's his last name. He was born into a family that ran the town and ran what was at the time the largest furniture-making operation in the world. And at the time of his birth in 1937, he was thought to one day run the show. But unfortunately for him, he was elbowed out by an older brother-in-law, equally brash, who sort of beat him to the post. And he emerged at a smaller company called Vaughn Bassett in 1982. And it was from that post that he took on China when the import boom really hit and threatened to take out all of the companies. And so what he did is from this sort of unlikely tiny mountain town in Virginia, he filed the largest anti-dumping petition in the world against China to prove that they were cheating and to keep his factory going.
So let's talk about a lot of those things. Let's go back a little bit and talk about the history of all that. Bassett Furniture was founded by his grandfather. They were known in the early days, I think I'm right to say, for being able to make furniture cheaper than the major manufacturers in the Northeast. And that's really how they got started and started making money, yes?
Yes, it was a key point. It was not long after the Civil War. They came out of that era being sort of cash poor and land rich. And they originally opened a sawmill because they had thousands of acres of land and free trees. And they heard the railroad was going to build a line through that area. And they thought, well, if we give them the land, our land to build it on, we can sell them the lumber for the ties. And, you know, just kind of one step ahead at that point. And then they started exporting lumber to the furniture factories in Michigan and New York, at which point his wife, whose name was Pocahontas, a.k.a. Miss Pokey, said, you know, John, I think we can do that. And they pretty much kind of swiped furniture making from the North at that point.
There are some ways in which this book is truly intrinsically a story about the South. Does that make sense to you?
I would say so, yes. I mean, it sort of tells the history of what happened after the Civil War. And sharecroppers and subsistence farmers in rural Virginia, eager to join the cash economy in 1902, they employed blacks for, unlike most of their competition in North Carolina, which you could say was progressive, but was also very shrewd because they paid them half of what
they
paid.
And they had a plantation mentality, essentially.
Exactly, yes, yes. They had had a farm and had had some slaves during the war. And, it was a paternalistic time and a very paternalistic company, as were most of the companies in the mill towns in the South.
You make the point that They succeeded because of the cheaper furniture. They used veneers. They used techniques that the guys in the Northeast did not use. Mm-hmm. And so they did well financially, but they were looked down upon by much of the business world, weren't they?
Yeah. In 1967, Fortune magazine sent someone down and wrote kind of a brilliant article, actually. Like, as a reporter looking back on that, it was a wonderful snapshot of the industry and the history of the industry. But I was told when somebody gave it to me sort of under the cover of darkness and told me never to tell where I'd gotten this magazine because they still feared, like, you know, repercussions from the family. I was told that the family hated the article. And once I read it a time or two, I thought, this is very dismissive. And it was very sort of looking down on Southerners from being backwoods and Rube Goldberg assembly line techniques. And
you quote from the article in the book, if you don't mind my reading it, one paragraph that you've included in your book is, "The unincorporated town of Bassett, Virginia is the headquarters of the world's largest manufacturer of wood furniture. It is also one of the last examples of a dying appendage of industry, the company town dominated by a single family. Employees of Bassett Furniture enter the world in a Bassett-endowed hospital. They're educated in the John D. Bassett High School. They live in Bassett houses, work in one of six local Bassett plants, deposit their savings in a Bassett bank, and worship at the Pocahontas Bassett Baptist Church." No wonder they didn't want you to see that.
But, I mean, if you talk to anybody in the town, that it's just that's the truth. They didn't like being called backwards, and they didn't like, because they were, you know, they were sophisticated at the time. They were on their way to being Fortune 500, and shouldn't no Yankee come down and call them the daddy rabbits. You know, they didn't like that. And in some ways, I don't blame them.
One of the things that your book does is to tell the really kind of rollicking, exciting, epic story of the family, its fights, and part of that has to do with John III. When John III was born, his grandfather, the founder, wrote a letter to him that John III kept on his office wall. What was essentially the letter all about?
It was saying, "My dear boy, I'll be long gone by the time you grow up and grow into running this business, but we expect you to do very big things," basically, was the gist of it. And it was accompanied by a check that was to pay his hospital bill, you know, from his birth. And he carried it around with him to his every office that he had. And when he first got out of the Army after college, his father was the CEO. And he had the office next to his father's. And it was really thought that when his father retired, then he would get the helm. His father was diagnosed very unexpectedly with stage 4, I think it was, throat cancer, died very unexpectedly and quickly.
John III had a sister, Jane, mm-hmm. who married Bob Spillman.
Mm-hmm.
And your book suggests that it was Jane who essentially made it sure that her husband, Bob, would end up taking over the business, that John III would not end up with that job. She was a tough customer, apparently.
She was a tough customer. I mean, she was a Bassett. The Bassetts, born in Bassett and run by Bassett, I mean, they were not to be taken lightly. And in some ways, she's kind of, she was a woman who got out of college in the 50s, smart as a tack. Everybody, you know, they would say things like to her face, like, if she wore pants, Jane would be the CEO. There's no question. If she were a man. And a lot of people in town think that what happened is that she, because, you know, she had grown up going to the factories with her father on Sundays after church and was very interested in the business. And a lot of people think because it was just not done in the 50s, a woman was not a CEO of a company, especially in a place like Bassett, Virginia, that she had sort of consciously or subconsciously sort of finagled to get her husband the spot. And there was no question he was a very bright guy. He was older than little John and, had a lot of good experience, too. But that story is just kind of whispered all over town,
well,
still today.
In the interviews you did with his sister, Jane, she complained to you that she was cut out completely. But when you talk to others, you got a different story, that she, in fact, was the one who sat at the dinner table every night and told Bob how to run the business in many ways.
Perhaps. She said, she says no. She says, you know, it used to break my heart that he didn't really discuss it with me. But others who lived nearby and were in and out of the house begged to differ. I mean, it was a tough story to get your head around. And the Bassett family members themselves, for the most part, didn't really want to talk about it very much.
Let's move ahead, because I think it's the later part of the story where we see the iron will of John Bassett III, and where the story about domestic production and foreign labor becomes a really important thread that you pick up. Mm-hmm. John III was eventually shipped off to Galax, Virginia, where he took charge of a company called Vaughan Bassett, as you mentioned before.
Right. And when he got there, it's a privately held company, unlike Bassett, which I think is an important distinction to make. It was struggling. It was losing money. Their creditors were after him. And he decided he was going to employ some Bassett 101, you know, teach him how it was done. And in part, not just to get the company more solvent, but also to show the folks back in Bassett who the real factory man was, I think.
And one of the things that happened, and this plays out over a long period of time, and your book documents it in great detail, is that one after the other, American furniture manufacturers, including the Bassett Company, exported all of their manufacturing to China, but not Vaughan Bassett, not John III. Why didn't he just go ahead and take the easy route?
I think it's complicated. I think he had a lot of ego invested in it. I think because it's a privately held company and he had a lot of his assets invested in it, it was probably also a good business decision because he was one of the low-cost producers. And I think he cared about the generations of workers and families that had toiled in that plant. You know, the plant was originally founded in 1919 by his grandfather and his wife, grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, deep ties in both of those communities to that couple. And so when he landed there in 1982 and he got it not just profitable, but really humming along, and then this happened, you know, only to, soon as he gets it up and really going, only to have this competition come in.
Chinese started dumping cheap furniture on the American market.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what he did was he thought they were dumping. He wasn't sure. He didn't even know at first, nor did many.
What does that mean, by the way? What does dumping mean?
Dumping means illegally selling furniture in the American market in an effort to capture the American market share for less than it costs even to produce it, with the idea of, I'm going to put you out of business, Americans. I'm going to come in and capture your market share. And then maybe I'll raise my prices a little bit once I've done that.
So John Bassett III fought, in fact, to have the Chinese cited for dumping and won a huge settlement.
Huge,
yes?
Huge case, but they did win. And the companies that won that still had domestic production were able to get duties put on the Chinese factories
furniture
that were cheating, and then were able to, they were ideally supposed to put it back into their factories to keep those jobs going. Not all of them did.
It's a long saga, but in the long run, do you think to some extent John III was an American hero? Because he insisted on keeping workers employed in his factories in Virginia and other places, and he kept going, whereas the other furniture companies eventually many of them went out of business. There's a very sad sequence toward the end of your book in which we see the landscape of empty furniture factories that Bassett.
Some of the companies still working, though. I mean, that's the interesting thing. I don't think I quite understood when I started this piece, because I'm not a business reporter, that the executives and the people doing the logistics and the designers, I mean, they're still all fabulously employed. It's the people in the company towns that did all the work making the products that lost their jobs, which is why, you know, Martinsville, Virginia has the highest unemployment rate in the state for over a decade now. And really the question that set me down to that region, which is about an hour away from my home in Roanoke, Virginia, to begin with, was what happened to those workers? What happens to a community when half of the jobs go away? half of the jobs in one community left, first textiles and then furniture. And
the high-end workers kept their jobs, the designers and the like, because they could continue to do their work and have the furniture built in an outsourced situation.
Exactly, exactly. At one point, I met a displaced worker from another furniture factory just, you know, a few miles down the road from Bassett called Stanley Furniture in Stanleytown, Virginia, another little company town. And she says at the beginning of the book, I'd like you to go to Indonesia and tell me why it is we can't make it here anymore. And so in some ways, the whole book was written to sort of answer that question. Why can't we make it here anymore?
Because we're sitting in Atlanta, Georgia, I have to ask you about, there's a role in your book that that a Bassett manager in Dublin, Georgia plays.
When the competition got really fierce from Asia, a gentleman who ran the Dublin plant by the name of Buck Gale, and he had grown up in Bassett, Virginia. His father, Finley Gale, ran the WM Bassett plant in Martinsville, which is a subject of another family feud and saga. But one of the things Buck had did, because he saw it coming and he was really worried and he knew those workers and really loved those people, is he said, I'm going to figure out how we can compete. And so he went into his workshop in his backyard on the weekends, and he figured out basically what IKEA has proved, which is how to make furniture, like how to take a dresser and change the faceplate out on it in like Mediterranean, Italian, different style, and how to make it really quick and cheap. And he figured it out, and they were making money on it, hand over fist, still when the plant was closed, because the CEO and the board had made the decision that they didn't want to sell low-end furniture anymore. They wanted to be more like Ethan Allen. They wanted to go vertical and sell a slightly higher-end product that they weren't ever really known for selling in their Bassett Home Furnishing stores.
Who was Larry Moe?
Larry Moe was a great character I had heard about early on in my reporting. And he was Chinese-born, Taiwan-reared, really smart guy, educated at the Wharton School, who returned to Taiwan, first in Hong Kong, actually, set up the first furniture factory in Hong Kong designed for the export of furniture for American stores. And, you know, made the furniture bigger because we're way bigger than the Asians, and really figured out how to do it and really became a master at globalization. Was you know, once the labor rates went up in Hong Kong, then he went to Thailand. Then he, you know, once China started opening up, then he went there. I mean, he was always, as his son told me, we were always one step ahead.
And Larry Moe was able to see what Larry Moe did to Bassett, what John Bassett, the founder, had done to the Northeastern furniture companies. He found a way to take things that Bassett was selling and make them cheaper overseas and sell them in the United States, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
In some ways, and you really address this quite early on in your book, I think you see factory ban as an argument against Tom Friedman's The World is Flat. Is that correct?
Perhaps. I was certainly educated by reading that book. And what struck me, and I wasn't that familiar with him until I started working on this book and somebody suggested it and I read it. And, you know, I went through the book once I really kind of got familiar with the story I wanted to tell and the business scope. And I looked at the number of pages that he dedicated to the displaced workers. And, you know, it was very few. I think I say in there what it was, but you could count them on one hand.
Friedman's argument is that globalization is good for the economy, but go ahead.
Right. So, yeah. So we can all get blue jeans and bedroom suits a little bit cheaper. But and I understand why he reported on it, because it was so exciting and it was new and it was happening. And he was going all over Asia at the time, you know, everywhere, and writing about this huge global change. I'm not knocking him for that, but I think there was an aftermath story right here in our country that was overlooked in his arguments. And you're only starting to see the economists talk about it now. What happened in those communities like Bassett, like Henry County and Martinsville, that were so locked into manufacturing, that those communities may never recover, or it may be decades.
These deserted factories, you pointed out, people out of work, communities devastated.
Growing their own food, standing in line on Canes 2 hours before the food pantry opens. You know, the food pantry director told me he could divine what people used to do for work by their disfigurements. The men who had culled lumber were missing fingers, and the women who made sweatshirts, which was also what that region was known for, had, you know, from hunchbacks from sitting over sewing machines for decades upon decades. And that he could tell when they came to the food pantry for their old box of food that this was their last resort. It was just devastating. And one of the things I had thought when I really thought this was just kind of a more simpler hero story when I wrote my book proposal and sold it to Little Brown. And I had done a chapter outline, 27 chapters. I thought the book would end with this triumphant moment where John Bassett, he's won his case, and now he's bringing good news to Galax. He's announced that because he's gotten these duties, he's going to reopen a vacant plant next door and call it Von Bassett 2, and it's a heroic moment. And then I thought, no, I can't do that because that's the outlier story. My heart was back in Bassett. I had spent so many weeks and months there, driving there, talking to people, seeing globalization from the ground up, watching those factories being torn down, buried in a ravine, watching displaced workers like go and pick up commemorative bricks because that was what they had. From that, you know, to represent what they had done, and it was important to them, and the promises made to them when China joined the WTO in 2001, and it was going to be a win-win because President Clinton said we'd be exporting more goods to growing consumer class in China. You know, it was a great economic theory, but if you go to those towns, and they're all over America, it didn't really happen that way, or it hasn't yet. And so this grand economic theory doesn't really help those people. And I had to end the book with that. I just had to. And I felt for those people and I connected with them on a pretty deep level. And so when at the end of the book, you know, they want to give me a factory brick, it was very moving to me.
Beth Macy is the author of Factory Man, the story of the rise and fall of the Bassett Furniture Company, and the story of how one man fought globalization to keep U.S. workers employed, even as his competitors outsourced their manufacturing to cheap foreign markets. Bluegrass fiddle player and singer Eddie Bond had a firsthand experience with John Bassett III's Vaughn Bassett Furniture Company in Galax, Virginia. As a young man who needed work, Bond thought he'd try his hand at working on the furniture line at Vaughn Bassett. His mother had been doing that for many years. But Bond learned quickly it wasn't easy work. It was, however, great fodder for the song he wrote about working at Vaughn Bassett. It's called Furniture Factory Blues.
When I was just a young lad, footloose and fancy free.
That's it for this week's show. I hope you'll join me again next Saturday at 4 for another edition of Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Have a great week.
Furniture Factory Blues. Well, they put me to glue in blocks, and I said, this is a piece of pie.